So things have changed quite a bit over the last week or so, what with coronavirus and everything. One of the biggest things we've seen is closing of schools or reduction in school attendance, and a lot of online learning and things like that, which begs the question, is this an opportunity for us to change something about our education system that has needed to be changed?
The Family Freedom Podcast, voices of family and freedom. Now here's your host, Wendy Hart.
Today I'm excited to have Matt Throckmorton with me. Matt has been involved in educational politics for, as he says, a very long time. Matt was raised in the old mafia section of Vegas, which sounds fascinating to me. But he's been involved in the legislature, in charter schools, as well as any sort of educational policy from Utah to Tennessee. So Matt, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
As you've watched this latest round of everything going on in the last week with closing of schools and changing of delivery methods, what have been some of your thoughts?
Well, you know, lemonade out of lemons, right?
Right.
So everybody's shutting down and all that stuff. And it really begs the question, when you get into these situations, like, what was the priority deliverable this whole time? And so, like, as all this happens, I think within a week, all of America is going to be, you know, kind of de facto homeschool, which is kind of awesome. And so from then, we get to totally, like, reprioritize what should we be doing in public education. I just think the opportunities are limitless. So it should be, if we do it right, could be a lot of fun.
That's a good lemonade. Could be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Sweet lemonade, a little southern thing.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of Tennessee, right?
Yeah.
So my thought process has been, you know, I've read different things, like homeschoolers want to make sure that what people understand is that there's a different legal definition for homeschool versus what we're seeing this week and going forward, where homeschoolers kind of want to be kept separate. But what you're saying about prioritizing what we're doing in schools, oftentimes I think we find that when things go wrong, we try to push it on to the schools. So the schools have been absolutely the end-all be-all for everything. And so anytime we need to fix something, it's, well, let's do another program in school and let's do this program in school. And now we've got some states where the U.S. Department of Education has said, hey, maybe you won't have to do your end-of-year state testing. Is that a good thing and why?
Oh my gosh, I'm totally in love with that. But, you know, you mentioned the end all be all of everything. So in Utah, there was a lobbyist who requested an audit with a really simple question. And that was, how many reports are mandated of the public education system in a given year? And the auditor came back in between formal reports, but then surveys. And, you know, in surveys, you get an email from an assistant secretary or an assistant superintendent or something saying, hey, you've got 3 weeks to give me these answers.
Mm-hmm.
Over 400 different reports and surveys. I mean, there's 180 school days and over 400 different reports.
Wow, do that,
and
man.
It is just, oh my gosh, it's totally insane. And so, you know, schools, the individual school itself, like the administration, instead of being a support in the classroom, curriculum, anything like that, I mean, they're doing paperwork. And so this, like, throws all that out the window. And so now what data do they actually really need? And so then you get to the assessment. You know, it's kind of the agreed upon lie across America. I don't know how many conversations I've had where you push people, district people, on the end of year test, and it doesn't take that long before they're like, well, yeah, we know it's a fundamentally flawed test. And you ask them, so what would you do different? And, you know, they all have, like, wonderful answers, and their answers are different other than they would get rid of the test. And so, you know, Texas, I guess the governor of Texas just announced formally in writing that they're canceling their test. I predict within a couple of weeks, and, you know, it's not like this is rocket science, it's just pretty reasonable. I think within a couple of weeks, most of America will be dumping the test. And so now what? And, you know, it's time for us to jump in there and grab the reins of this. And
well, that speaks to the priorities, right? Up until this moment, the test has been the priority because everything seems to be based on it. And in Utah, I know it's been, we've gone the rounds, but it's been pretty difficult because the parents have the right to opt their kids out of testing. But the education establishment really feels this pressure to have the testing. Like you said, when you talk to people, they readily admit that it's a flawed system. You know, one of my kids' principals has said it's really unfair to judge kids based on one test at one point in the year that, you know, maybe they had a bad day, maybe they're getting sick. So even if the test itself were good, to make that, you know, a high stakes sort of environment adds a whole other level to the importance of the test that it doesn't merit. And then we in Utah, and I think around the country based on the No Child Left Behind turnaround stuff, you have turnaround laws. And so if you don't score well enough on the test, then all of a sudden everything gets thrown into, well, we could replace your administration, we could replace your teachers. That's a huge level of stress based on a single test for a single individual.
These tests, the only thing that they consistently predict or reflect is socioeconomics. Mm-hmm. And so all the schools, they get A's and B's. They're all, I mean, frankly, they're all wealthy Caucasian communities. And all the schools getting D's and F's are minority and overwhelmingly poverty. I mean, what have we accomplished with these tests? We could figure that out through different means. So
it's like doing a DNA test to find out what color your eyes are.
Could be, yeah, pretty expensive test, yeah.
And something we could look at and say, yeah, that's probably going to be an issue.
So many of these politicians and bureaucrats, they feel trapped into it. I mean, it's just, this is how it's done, this is why it's done. And at this point, two decades on, not quite two decades, of No Child Left Behind in this whole test-centric model, I mean, entire academic careers, PhDs, are all built on the premise that everybody has to take and pass a test. So there's just so much momentum in this. But this becomes this, hopefully, this big break.
So what did we do before? What did we do before? I mean, you and I are old enough, I think. I know I am, to remember what it was like before standardized testing. How were we educated?
Statistical sampling. Yeah, it was, I mean, old school. We memorized the multiplication tables. We, you know, learned phonics, how to, you know, deconstruct words by sound and such. I'm not an expert on those things, but, and then on the testing, everybody's addicted to testing. I had lunch with, there were a bunch of us that had lunch with the, I can't remember his actual title, Minister of Education from Finland. This is like 5-6 years ago when Finland was all the rage, is super high performing, and they're still pretty high performing. But he kind of chuckled when somebody asked him. He said, you know, when a patient's sick, you don't test every drop of blood. You just do a blood test, and that gives you the feel of the patient. He's like, here in America, you test everybody, and you don't need to do that. So,
ooh, fascinating. So the idea of the NAEP sampling actually makes a lot of sense, and we've been doing that forever.
Yeah.
Yeah, where we don't test every kid.
The story of the NAEP, and I know there's cynicism around the NAEP, you know, their sampling. There was one principal that I hired who, he was cynical of it because he's like, you know, he'd been at the school for like, a previous school for like 15 years, and he said, like, for 15 years, we had been randomly selected to take the NAEP. And so that just tells me that they kind of met the socioeconomics or whatever that they statistically sampled. But Massachusetts has a very compelling story, which is they had a really low performing, you know, by all measures, they were pretty low performing. So they took the NAEP, they reverse engineered it, created some standards. They then began testing new teachers, and the new teachers had to pass, I think it was the equivalent of a 10th grade test or something like that. And if they couldn't pass the test, they couldn't be a teacher. But they went to just some really, you know, old-fashioned classic standards, and they rapidly climbed to the highest performing state in the nation. Mm-hmm. But it was old school techniques.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they dumped those standards to go with Common Core, and they've been in decline ever since.
Right, which has been everybody. I mean, California had fantastic math standards as well. When I was growing up, I remember a handful of times, you know, coming into school And the teacher would say, okay, get out your number two pencils. And we had the old Scantron forms, and we'd fill that out. We never did test prep. I never got the impression that this was life or death or anything like that. It was just kind of like, oh, this is what we're doing for a half hour. And it literally, it was like a half hour. It was not any more than that. It wasn't 3 or 4 days of testing. But my teachers would give me grades, and I would have tests, and they were tests that my teacher would create. We've kind of gotten away from some of that. I mean, I know our teachers are still creating tests, but I know in our school district that I was on the board of, there was a lot more focus on the common assessments. An assessment may not even be a test. And again, like in drama, you don't really want a test necessarily. The spring musical would be the test. But for math, for example, it seems like everybody's giving, you know, group tests. I mean, they're written as a group as opposed to my teacher writing up his or her test for me. Have you seen that trend, and what's your opinion on that?
So the trend is, just by observations, primarily it's the real veteran teachers. They close their doors and they do write their own little quizzes and those types of things. But the general trend in education, now they're doing the end of year tests. In Utah, it's the SAGE, the RISE, the ASPIRE. Now it's back to the SAGE. Mm-hmm. But in 3 years, three tests. It's crazy. But they then have benchmarks. And so, you know, you're practicing to take the test that you'll take at the end of the year. It's like you're an ACT prep mm-hmm. the entire year. You know, the test, and they always correct. They're not a test, they're an assessment, because there's no pass-fail. But are you familiar with NWEA?
Yeah, the NUA.
I really like that one. You know, they have two versions. One is on the Common Core standards. The other one is on old school standards. But, you know, the whole test might run you 45 minutes. You know, but then they have little, I call them snap tests. Might be less than 10 minutes, you know, 5 to 10 minutes, just a handful of questions. And you can do that more frequently. But they break it down all the way down. Their standards align. And for a teacher, they can go all the way down to see how individual kids are doing on concepts. So really short, simple things that they can work with. But to your point, like, the best is their real teacher-driven teacher engagement. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I have a friend who taught English in junior high for like 25 years. And her comment was always, you know, she's talking about writing specifically, because in English, you know, we didn't necessarily have tests in English. You know, you had to have book reports and you'd have to write essays and things like that, which actually makes sense, right? But she said that her students would write to her as the teacher, and what they were writing for was not just the overall grade, but the comments that she would make in the margins. That's where you get that helpful individualized, you know, instruction that we always talk about as being the ideal. When we've switched over so much of even our writing to being computer graded, How are kids getting that feedback anymore, I guess, is the question. And I think the answer is that they're probably not. But
yeah, I mean, kind of interesting. There's a series of schools up in New York City, Boston, you know, that area. They're called uncommon schools. Mm-hmm. Super high performing, and they do a lot of things that I really like. But they are totally built around the end of year test. But they do a lot of great things. One thing that they do is they have on each campus, and then they have a cluster of schools that they will have some curriculum experts, and all that they do is they write curriculum. And then as part of that, they have some individuals that all that they do is they write assessments. But these assessments, you know, that's the big word, but these are like quizzes, you know, small little quizzes, chapter tests, things of that nature. And so they've got a small team that's all that they do. And then they're providing material for the teachers. And then the teachers are just focused on delivering the material. So classroom management, engagement with the students, getting instant feedback, those types of things. And then as the data comes in, then those teachers sit down with, and this is kind of an old school practice when the principals really led everything that was going on academically, as opposed to 400 plus reports. Mm-hmm. But then this team, you know, they sit down with the teachers and they review on every single student, like the data that's being produced. And so on a weekly basis, they're changing up what they're doing to really support and get after the individual student. And just a lot of real success there. but they're engaging. So they're a new school. They've been around 20 years, but they're a new concept of schooling that really fits into this test-centric world, but yet they're engaging in really old school practices with great effect.
So still times tables?
For me, it makes the case. You know, I don't know if they do the times table or not.
Because, you know, that's my big thing, right?
So I'm a huge fan of them.
Well, I think
I know the world likes to live on the calculator, but
yeah, no. Baseline, there are certain things that you just need to know, right? And yeah. and it frees what I've seen, and there's quite a bit of evidence, you know, behind this that if you don't have a baseline minimum of knowledge, you might be able to look it up. It's that you can just Google it. You might be able to look it up, but it takes additional effort to look it up, and that takes away from your ability to just deal with whatever the issue is, whether it's finding analogies, solving problems. If you don't know that baseline piece of information to begin with, you may be missing other stuff because you're too focused on getting that baseline information that you're missing a bigger picture.
You know, you imagine a little kid, he's trying to figure out an algebra problem, and all of a sudden he's got to start counting on his fingers and toes to figure out, you know, how to just manipulate numbers around to solve, you know, for X.
Right.
And so now they're solving two problems within one problem, and it's discouraging, slows them down. They don't get it.
Yeah. Well, and I've mentioned this before on this podcast, but when you can't use a calculator, then the problems have to come out right. And so there's that automatic check. When you're solving a math problem, especially a higher level math problem, if you can't simplify it all the way down to wherever it's supposed to be simplified, you made a mistake and you have to go back. You can't just end up with the sine of 21.5 degrees, because nobody knows what the sine of 21.5 degrees is just offhand. But you can know the sine, you can memorize the sine of 30 degrees. So where did you go wrong between 21.5 and 30? You know, so there's that automatic check that develops that facility in you.
It just got a lot of theory, a lot of beauty. 20 years on, it's not working so well. So
yeah, absolutely.
Let's go with what works at this point.
So I think where we do agree is that a one size fits all doesn't work for every kid. And so the best option is options. And for parents and teachers to make those determinations, because, you know, we're going to see a lot with online schooling here, especially after, you know, these next several weeks. And I'm sure there are kids that would do really well with that, but I would assume that there are other kids who are going to struggle with the online. If we didn't have like a single set of tests, does that free up the ability of schools to be a little bit more open to different methods and ideas?
You know, I think, you know, just kind of a thought exercise, what I think is going to happen is, you know, everybody, they can explain in an elevator pitch, you know, in 30 seconds or less, what online type of learning is. Mm-hmm. And so what's happening right now is kids are at home, and schools nationwide, they think they're really clever because they've sent packets home to kids, or they've sent, you know, sent them links to things like, you know, assignments. And and everybody's grins and giggles for the first few days, but having, you know, led schools that have had significant online portions, it's not easy to deliver. And, you know, so, and if you have any breakdown in anything, so they can't access a password, or they have their password, they log in, but for some reason a link to an assignment isn't working. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a number of things that will break down. And so they have to have IT skills as well as being able to navigate, you know, the assignment itself. And then, you know, if they have any problem not understanding the assignment, you know, with an online learning component, and this is where Khan Academy has found some, you know, success. But in most other systems, they give you an example of how to do the problem. If you can't figure it out from that example, then all of a sudden you're on an Indiana Jones discovery mission, right? You've got to teach yourself how to accomplish that. Mm-hmm. And so for the first week, not a lot's going to get done. But by this week, because this, for most of America, is the first week that schools have been shut down, by Friday, they're going to discover that most of the kids are still struggling even to log in. By next week, I mean, in the next 2 weeks, almost no learning is going to take place in America. And so at the end of 2 weeks, teachers are going to be like, holy cow, we just blew 2 weeks in our schedule. And I worry that there's going to be The natural is everybody's going to go to their safe place, and their safe place is going to be right back into the way they've been doing it up until 2 weeks ago. And so I've warned a few people about this, that you've got to become really rapidly sophisticated about how you're going to deliver online learning. Otherwise, it's not going to work out so well. Schools that send home paper packets and such, and then I'm aware of some schools, and I've advised some schools that you should set up mentoring. Like, so in some states, they're saying you shouldn't gather more than 500. Some states, it's more than 100 people. Some states, it's like 20.
Mm-hmm.
But that they should cycle through, like, mentoring. So if it's in Utah, it's 100.
Right.
And so have 99 kids come in on Monday and just cycle the school population throughout the week, but have them come in with their assignments and have, you know, intense mentoring sessions and labs and, you know, provide those types of hands-on support for them. It's a blended learning environment. Mm-hmm. It would work really well. And those schools that do, I think they'll have some pretty good success.
That sounds interesting. I had not even thought about that aspect of it. But I do know that I have a neighbor whose son, it seems like almost once a week when he's submitting online assignments, he'll do the work, goes to submit, and it either won't submit or it gets rid of all of the work that he has done. And you only have to do that like once or twice before you're completely discouraged. So the IT aspect of this is very important. Do you see that...
It's a skill set all its own.
Yeah. Do you see that people are going to be narrowing what is delivered online or expanding that? I mean, I'm thinking initially it might be a narrowing, but over time, would we see things expand over to what's being delivered online? And how do we do things like band and orchestra and drama?
Well, so initially, what I also saw go out last week... are these wonderful lists of free resources, you know, 150 free programs. And so initially it's like this candy store of holy cow. And mm-hmm. then they're rapidly going to begin narrowing down to just a few things that work. And that's the smart thing, you know, but it gets to your point. What are the real basics that need to be delivered and how are they going to deliver those? And then in a traditional, you know, quote, traditional virtual blended online type of a class or a school, they start out with a few basic things and they do that for a few weeks, a month, until everybody's got their password, everybody's figured out how to submit. And it takes a few weeks, a month, just to learn how to navigate the software side of it or the delivery. And then after they get into that groove, then the kids start to get bored with seeing the exact same thing. So they need recess and activities. And that's where they start to like expand their offerings. So they'll do virtual tours, or they'll get together in a homeschool setting. They'll call them co-ops or whatever, and they'll get together and they'll do field trips.
Under 100.
They'll go through the cycles first. Yeah, under 100. But I think they start out with everything. They rapidly realize, okay, we got to get down to one or two things that we make work. And then once they get a groove there, then they start to expand their opportunities.
Awesome. So going back just to wrap up. So if you were education guru for the day, we have this opportunity. What, back to what you're saying, focus on individual basic things. How would you expand that to allow things to work for different kids that have different perspectives? I mean, I'm sure everybody wants kids to read and do basic math.
Do you know, you really have to get down. I mean, we've completely disrupted America, our education. So if you're taking advanced physics or robotics or things of that nature, I mean, you are just in a tough spot. And so as a system, I would get rid of the tests, you know, suspend them for the full year, encourage the districts to come up with some kind of a, you know, an internal assessment school tool. Most have them, so that's no big deal. And then get it right down to what are the most basics that need to be delivered. And they can now have that conversation because the tests are gone. So the stress of, oh my gosh, they
what
might kill our
do?
School if we
right.
don't pass. And then from there, I would, you know, instantly be identifying and training schools and teachers and parents on some blended techniques. Technology is awesome, but at some point you need a person to just help, you know, totally old school, help you get through things. And it's in the blended environment where I think the system as a whole would find the greatest success. And in that environment, that's where you could, you know, get back to doing robotics and physics and all those other things that you need more of a presence to accomplish. So, but at the end of that, I could see like entire schools that, you know, some kids are going to they're little Lisa Simpson. So they completely thrive on a Monday through Friday, sit in a chair the whole time with the teacher and, you know, the traditional. Other kids, especially boys, are going to do a lot better with a lot more, you know, robust engagement in and out of the classroom. And, you know, they could really change things up with some blended. And then I also, there's a real hostility in America towards homeschoolers, and that's just got to end. We got to see homeschooling as like a great foundational piece of education in our society and do what we can to, you know, start by not obstructing it. And then if we can find ways to support it, that would be awesome.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know in Utah, we do have some legislation because of that, that, you know, because homeschool parents pay taxes, right? You hear this, but they don't get, quote unquote, any benefit educationally. And so homeschool kids can participate in extracurriculars at their local schools. And is that kind of what you're thinking, or just in general where the homeschool person is kind of, and I can say this because I homeschool, that the homeschool parent is just a little bit weird and their kid's going to turn out just a little bit odd. Again, there are kids who really thrive in that environment because there's so much more flexibility for them. And so I agree with you that it needs to change, but I'd be interested to hear how you think that needs to change.
In Utah specific, on paper, they have some great concepts. So you can do the sports and you can cherry pick any class that you want. But when it comes to what takes place at home, I mean, I guess down to the most philosophical, homeschool families pay taxes just like everybody else. But the state is extremely restrictive on how they will allow that tax dollars to be spent in support of what goes on in a homeschool environment. And so homeschoolers are forced into, most of them, you know, it's easiest just to describe it as you're either in or out. And if you're in, you have very narrow, you know, access to curriculum, those types of things. If you're out, you can get whatever curriculum you want, but you're paying twice, right? You pay your regular taxes, now you have to pay for your own.
Yeah,
I know in Colorado, I've heard it described as free range kids. I get a kick out of it. I hope that doesn't offend anybody, but They have much greater latitude in the resources, so tax dollars. You know, they sign up with a charter school or a traditional school. They have greater latitude on curriculum. The school only receives half the funding, but the trade-off is, you know, the families get much greater latitude, so everybody comes out pretty happy with that. I've not heard any complaints. I wish more Utah and others would adopt something like that.
Mm-hmm. But that kind of goes back to the testing, because what I saw, and you've probably seen some of this as well, with the imposed testing, even your charter schools that receive full funding from the state, they've become more limited in what they can offer because of the testing, I would argue. So even if you can adopt standards that are acceptable, and, you know, we won't even go into how horrible the Common Core standards are, but if you could get a decent set of standards, the testing is really what compels you to teach a certain way, is it not?
Correct. I mean, it's the sandwich, right? On the front end, you have the standards. On the back end, you have the test. And then in the middle, you have curriculum. And they say, oh, do whatever you want. But if you really want to do well on the test and avoid the, you know, the prison and all the bad things, here's curriculum that do really well on the test. And so our test is really written not only to, you know, kind of default curriculum, but it's also written to pedagogy. You know, so it's a very limiting, the way it's handled is just very limiting, very one size fits all. And so, like in Colorado, they have to take, I believe, and somebody, you know, could correct me, but it was explained to me that if they don't take the end of year test, then they have to take an LEA test. So it could be the Stanford Achievement, it could be the Iowa, it could be one of these traditional tools. And
so there are more options.
Much more flexible.
Because I know I've spoken with a handful of people about what if instead of having the SAGE, RISE, Aspire, SAGE package that the state board mandates, And arguably that the feds mandate through, you know, No Child Left Behind and now ESSA. What if we had a, you know, five or six tests you could pick from, you know, like you said, the Iowa or even the classical learning test, or, you know, that the states could say, pick one of these. Does that free things up quite a bit?
Substantially. You know, I know in Florida with their voucher, which, you know, is treated kind of as a quasi-public, you know, mm-hmm. expenditure, the schools that accept the voucher, they're given a list of like 15, 18 different nationally norm reference tests, and they pick one of those. And I guess Arizona's headed that way. In Utah, I had some of our staff, one of our staff members, he's a total geek, an awesome guy. He's got a PhD in geekology, and he's awesome. But he built a concordance table, and a concordance table is just a big fancy word for a conversion table. You know, if you're 6 feet tall, it's this many centimeters, right? Mm-hmm. And so he built a concordance table, and he was able to build this statistically significant model that if you scored so much on the SAT, it would predict this on the ACT, it would predict this on the ASVAB, it would predict this. He was able to build that across six or seven different tests, and then he got to the Utah test, and it was impossible to build a concordance, the Utah test, into it because the data was not statistically significant. And I just found that is just, so those 15, 18 tests in Florida, I highly suspect you could build a concordance table that would just draw a straight line through every one of those tests. Mm. And if you want to talk about a good function, that's a great function. And then when you go to the state test, and you can't do that at the state test because, frankly, it's
garbage.
You know, it's not validated and such. I mean, what does that tell you about the state test?
Yeah.
So well, we should be going with the straight line.
Well, that was the big red flag for me, was when we threw out our old standards and adopted the new Common Core standards, we also threw out our old testing and adopted the new testing, which it ended up being SAGE testing in Utah. But we were told repeatedly that you could not correlate the scores between the old tests and the new tests. And that made, you know, I'm a math geek, that made no sense to me until I realized that none of this was independently validated. And that after they set the cut scores, they renormed them down to fit into a particular, it was arbitrary, that the cut score was completely arbitrary. From what I found, they knew they wanted a 40th percentile pass rate because that's what the ACT says we are college ready is at 40%, and the NAEP says we're in the 40 percentile range for college ready. And so when they all was said and done, they came back down and they said, okay, these are our cut scores, but now we need to bring it down so that the average pass rate is in the 40th percentile. Well, that would screw things up anyway, even if it were a statistically valid test.
Yeah, and that's the dirty little secret of all this. I remember I was doing charter school work in Memphis, and I was at a school board meeting, Memphis City Schools, which is now Shelby County Schools, but there's this old guy. It's the only time I ever talked to him, and he gave me his business card, and he says, you know what, I'm retiring, I don't care. But he was the director of assessments for Memphis City Schools. I introduced myself, we got talking, and he said, you know what the cut scores are here? And, you know, the standard test, there's 55 questions, five of them are survey questions, so kind of testing if it's a well-written question or not. The other 50 questions make up the test. And he's like, do you know how many questions you have to get right to be considered proficient? And it's because of this cut score, and because they want to show a certain percentage proficient. It was six questions of math. So if you got six out of 50 right, you were considered proficient. Now,
wow.
That's 10 years ago, but it just makes the point. It's just
whatever you want to show. It's how to lie with statistics, right?
So can I tell you another?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, so I was in the Utah legislature when President Bush was elected. He did his No Child Left Behind. And in the hallways, in our closed caucus meetings, I mean, the discussion amongst Republican legislators, the single reason that we were jumping on board this is that we had explained to us this whole norm referencing, which means you're going to have to do cut scores. And this came out of Texas. It came out of Houston, Texas. And there was a great big negotiation with the teachers union. It got kind of nasty. So they went to this test-centric model where every kid was going to be tested, but it was norm-referenced. What they realized is that no matter what, at least half the kids were going to fail the test. And then when the teachers came back and said, we want a pay raise, you could patronize them and say, oh, that's so awesome. But, you know, when half the kids are failing, we can't give you a pay raise. And here we are. And so this whole test-centric model is 100% designed to kill the teachers union. But wow. Along the way, we convinced ourselves it was about education.
That's fascinating. Things I learn.
Yeah. Oh, that's when you know you're good at sales pitch, when you fool everybody.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. And it has completely changed everything that we've done. It's focused on the test. And now the greatest proponents, it seems, are the, you know, not individual teachers, but the entire education establishment is pushing towards the test. And that's the metric.
Like I said earlier, you know, their whole PhD, their whole everything is based on the premise that they can finally make this work. And it's like, you've made it work. We've killed the unions. Now let's go on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. But we're stuck.
Yeah, we're stuck. Well, Matt, this has been really educational for me. I appreciate it. And hopefully we'll be able to see some good things coming forward, the lemonade from the lemons of the coronavirus. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for the time.
This has been the Family Freedom Podcast with Wendy Hart. Follow this podcast, share with your friends and neighbors, and add to the Voices of Family and Freedom.